Well, Judge Teresa Cardenhove, welcome to Newsworks Tonight.
Thank you for inviting me today.
20 years on the bench, you did preliminary hearings for major felony cases. You tried a lot of cases, so you saw the district attorney's office come in day after day. What's one thing that needs to change?
Well, I get to see the district attorneys coming in right from the beginning. So we see them at the preliminary hearings. We see them at the trials. I think the attitude of going for the jugular is not necessary. And some come in with that as their MO. And I think that is one thing that definitely needs to change. People in criminal justice today are maybe even a little closer to social workers because of things like the opioid crisis and the untreated mental illness in our city. And there are just programs that fit some of these situations that we have to educate ourselves about, make ourselves aware of, develop new programs, and direct those with low-level nonviolent crimes into programming so that they are not return customers.
One of the things I've heard talking to others about this is that the current diversion programs begin with a criminal case, and then a judge says, you're going to go to treatment. If you stick with it, if you do your urine tests and the monitoring, you can avoid a criminal conviction. A lot of people don't make it. Addicts, kicking addiction is hard. So we end up paying for that treatment and then putting them in jail anyway. That we need a whole new system. Do you agree?
I agree. And I'm also, my position on this is evolving as we speak because initially, I thought, I think along with a lot of other people, that sobriety was the goal. However, I've come to understand that when there's a drug addiction of any substantial time, that the brain may be rewired and may require medication. So medication-assisted treatment is becoming more the avenue that's looked at to make sure that people don't come back.
We know that there are a lot of people in prison here who may never be convicted of the offense they're charged with. They're there because they can't raise a cash bail. Should we end cash bail? How should that be changed?
Well, cash bail should not be the first resort. People should be given an opportunity to show up for their cases. Of course, if they repeatedly don't do that, then they have to be subjected to cash bail. But otherwise, I mean, if a person has a job and a family and things like that, I think we can rely on them to show up in many more cases than are currently, you know, and we are operating on guidelines that are more than 20 years old, where they ask for, you have to ask for this amount of bail, that amount of bail. And it's not working. It's too expensive. I think when we those guidelines were first put into place, it was never envisioned that we would have overpopulated prisons like we have today.
There's a very controversial program of civil asset forfeiture in which the district attorney's office will seize assets of people suspected of crimes, sometimes never convicted, sometimes never charged. It's under legal challenge. What's your view of that practice?
I think it is wrong. I think it's immoral. And I think that this is where prosecutorial discretion is very important. We are taking homes from people whose relatives might be exchanging a bag of weed in front of their house and they don't even know about it. And before anybody's even convicted, the home is being seized. And it's just on its face. It's unfair and it's got to stop.
How do you feel about the way the office has handled police misconduct cases? Is there a need for change there?
Police in Philadelphia are a step above what we've seen in other cities. So I don't think there's a great amount of police misconduct. However, when there is, it seems that the subsequent evaluation always seems to give the police officers their jobs back.
The arbitration system?
The arbitration system, thank you. Whether it's being held, I mean, there are trials. Some people are dissatisfied with the results of those trials. Sometimes they don't go to trial. Now, that the new DA's recommendations best practices is indicating that names not be released unless there's an arrest.
That's a case of a police shooting.
Yes. But I think, and that is what happens generally in journalism when somebody's a suspected of a crime, but they're not arrested. They don't release the names. And I think, you know, what's good for the goose is good for the gander. Whatever happens for the general public should also happen with the police. I don't think we should put them in danger because they have dangerous jobs and we need them. And I think the police, the prior commissioner subjecting the department to a federal review and the current commissioner having satisfied almost all of the conditions that were requested, I think we should have more confidence in our police in Philadelphia, that they want to do the right thing, and most of them are trying to do the right thing. There's always going to be a few bad apples, and then they have to be dealt with.
What's your view of the death penalty?
I will not take the death penalty off the table. I think it should be reserved for the most heinous crimes, but I am not going to invite a terrorist into this city with some guarantee that they will not face the death penalty. So, or any other situation. There are some heinous situations where the death penalty is appropriate. In those cases, I will go for it. I will not, as a practice, go for it just because it can happen under the guidelines. But in an appropriate case where discretion allows it, I will go for it.
You heard tens of thousands of cases as a judge in 21 years. One in 2007 got a lot of attention. It involved a prostitute in a rape prosecution. The facts, as I understand them, was she agreed to have sex with a man for money, agreed to have a second participant for an additional fee. Instead, four men, armed men show up, and she says she was forced to have sex at gunpoint with four men. The case came before you, as I understand it. You reduced the charge to theft of services,
no.
And it generated a ton of controversy.
Yes, because those facts are inaccurate.
Okay, set us straight.
Well, it was a preliminary hearing, and the standard is whether or not there's sufficient evidence to find probable cause to hold whoever is before me, the defendant, for whatever they're charged with. People say that I reduced the charges of theft of services. I did not. But I let me say this also, that since that time, I have learned a lot more about sex trafficking. At the time, the woman, the way she was describing it, and I don't want to bring these people back into the spotlight because I think everybody deserves their privacy, but she spoke of it as though it were a business deal gone wrong, and I gave her the benefit of her testimony and held it as a robbery.
But you didn't hold the defendant over for a rape trial.
I did not,
right.
But that also is a signal. Often, I mean, there are cases every day that are not held for court, and the DA's office simply withdraws the case, refiles it, brings it back, buttresses the case somewhat, and it is held. And that case, the mistake I made was trying to explain it because it's very complicated. There's a lot of nuances to it, and I happen to have a chancellor of the bar whose only accomplishment during her period of chancellorship was trying to destroy my reputation. So I've had to live with that, and I think it's very unfair to try to define me by that one case. It's not fair.
It is only fair to note that whenever you ran for retention as a judge, you were rated as recommended by the Bar Association.
Yes, I was reelected. I was elected four times.
But in that case, you don't think the initial decision was wrong based on the evidence in court, but you also don't disagree with the fact that I think the defendant ultimately did plead guilty to rape, right?
He pled guilty to rape. He was offered a negotiated plea, and he accepted it.
You were, before you became a judge, a counsel for the Democratic Party. The party's very influential in elections like this, and there are those who say we shouldn't have ward leaders picking our judges or prosecutors. And I'm wondering what your view is of whether it's healthy for politicians to be involved in this process as much as they are. You know, some people see them as hacks doing favors for each other. What's your view of the party?
I don't see them as hacks at all. I see them as community leaders. And they are not the sole community leaders that help select the candidates that get elected. I mean, all the time that I worked there, you have ward leaders and committee people all over the city that are helping people navigate the system in Philadelphia. I mean, these people are doing this work with no pay. So I think they get a bad rap. And ward leaders are not the only community leaders that we go to for support. There's a variety of community leaders.
For political support in an election, you mean?
Yes, right. for political support, for financial support, for them to give us an opportunity to speak to their members. So, you know, it's not focused in solely on the ward leaders. Of course we want this party support. It's a party system. I'm running as a Democrat. I want the Democratic Party support. But I'm not getting any head start because I was their attorney. Believe me, I would have to earn this. I have to work for it just like everybody else.
Judge Teresa Carr-Denny, thank you so much for coming in.
Thanks very much for having me here. Thank you.